I don't care what class it is. I don't care what the subject is. If the teacher is amazing, you take that class. It doesn't matter. An amazing teacher will expose and open you up to things that you have never thought of before, never seen before. Even if you're like, oh God, I'm really not into medieval history, all that. I have an engineering degree, but amazing teacher, just take it.
Welcome to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast, where IT and digital leaders from around the world talk about their careers, their inspiration, and their vision for the future of digital business. I'm your host, David Wright. The world of digital business is evolving faster than ever, and I want this to be a place where digital business champions create a village to band together and help each other navigate the ever-changing terrain. Disruptive Innovators features conversations with CIOs and digital leaders from around the world, diving into their personal backstory, career, their current role, trends they've been seeing, and their vision for the future, personally, professionally, and otherwise. This podcast is made for people who are seeing how quickly the digital business landscape is evolving, those who recognize that it takes a village of trusted advisors to navigate this ever-changing terrain. People who enjoy listening to high-level discussions surrounding what it means to be a leader, real-world examples of challenges faced, and industry-specific strategies leveraged to create exceptional business outcomes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.
Good morning, friends. David Wright here, and I'm your host of the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. And today I am lucky enough to be joined by Mike Tedasco. Mike, it's a pleasure to have you on, man.
David, I'm happy to be here. Excited about this.
Yeah, I know it's been a long time in the making. So Mike, for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with your wide breadth of experience in the technology space, can you just talk a little bit about your current role?
Sure. I am a visiting fellow at the AI Center at San Diego State University. As part of that role, I write about AI. I do research and mentor and teach in the beautiful center that we have down in San Diego.
I love it. Yeah, the director of our PMO is from San Diego Health. I'm actually going to be out that way in a month or so for Chime Foundation.
San Diego is pretty awesome. And this is, actually don't live in San Diego. I live in the Bay Area, but whenever I could get down there, I'm more than happy to make that trip because it's beautiful down there.
As a New Yorker who loves the beach, like that city beach kind of dynamic there is very exciting to me, but I digress. So Mike, I want to get into a little bit about your journey, how you got to where you are today. I know you were at PayPal. Before we jump into any of that, I just like to start the episode with one piece of actionable advice you might look to leave the listeners with today.
Well, we're starting with the actionable advice. I like that.
To hit hard. Yeah,
don't wait till the end. Just get it up there up front. Look, the piece, and I'm going to make it AI related because I think we'll get into that heavy. And I will say, don't be afraid of these tools and just play with them. Like the one actionable specific thing I would say is make ChatGPT or Claude or whatever, make that the default home screen in your browser. Make it so that you just see it in front of you, because it takes some time to realize this is a new computing paradigm we're going down. And it just takes cycles for us to get comfortable, to play with it, to understand it better. And if I would just say one thing, make ChatGPT the default in your browser. So every time you pop open a new tab, you see ChatGPT, that is the best thing you could possibly do. Because it's going to then force, because defaults matter, that will force you into it. And then all of a sudden you're going to say, oh, I didn't know you could do this. I didn't know you could do this. And it's actually going to start really improving. And you'll start to see, oh, this is what AI can possibly do.
Love that. Sometimes I find myself saying that inaction is the biggest enemy of innovation.
Yeah. Yes. I think that with the world of innovation, you just got to try things. And here's the reality. Some of these things ain't going to work. And some of these things are going to be bad. And that is part of the experience of innovation. Like, not everything is going to be a home run. You're going to have some failures. If everything you did was a success, then you're probably not going trying hard enough. You're not extending yourself hard enough. And that's the same with products you try too. You might say, hey, I'm going to try this product for a week. And after a week, you said, you know what? ChatGPT is not for me. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't do this. It doesn't do that or whatever. And so be it. But at least you've gone in there to experience it, to do that work firsthand.
Yeah. Can't agree more. Even for me as a technologist, right? It took cycles of just, like you're saying, getting into it, getting into all the different GPTs that are available, right? Because there's so many. And I'm still trying to get Copilot to hum, admittedly. I was talking to a colleague the other day who was like, oh, I'm going to have Copilot go through my inbox. I was like, hey, I can have Copilot go through my inbox? I was like, all right, still have some work to do there. But
that's one of the great things about these tools is like we're learning, even if the tools stop getting better today, the ones that exist already, we are just starting to uncover what their potential actually is. And the one way to find this out is just talking to people about it, doing experiments, sharing your thoughts with the world of, hey, I did this for my kid's birthday party. I was able to use AI tools to create a whole experience around that. And that was effectively her birthday. And then I shared that with all of the parents that were there. And it was just another way where they were able to see, oh, I didn't know you could do that, because maybe they could bring that into their personal life or their work life. And having those types of conversations about email inboxes, whatever it might be, those are the ways that we're all going to learn more about how to use these tools better.
Love it. And I love how you keep referring to it as a tool, right? Because I think that's really important to hammer home for folks. It is just another tool we have available to us.
Well, I'm working on a piece right now. I don't know when this episode will come out, so I might have finished it by then. But sometimes by the end of October, I probably will have it, where I'm actually going to be surveying several hundred people about the phrase artificial intelligence. Because I think at least in the US, the phrase artificial intelligence is just toxic. And if you actually present people, hey, would you like to, is it okay to have AI spell check a document versus is it okay to have Google Docs or Microsoft Word spell check a document? I think people are going to say, no, it's not okay for AI to do it. When in reality, that's what Google Docs is using. That's what Microsoft Word is using. I like to fall back as much as I can to just say augmented intelligence, because David, it's exactly what you're talking about there. This is a tool for us to make our lives better, to make us more effective. These are not, I think the companies in many ways are at fault for this, because they've painted this far off future, which we may get to at some point, but we're definitely not at today, where these things are thinking autonomous type beings that are doing whatever they want to and humans cannot compete. We're nowhere near that today. And everything that these tools do just can augment us, can make us better, can make us faster, can make us smarter, can do whatever it takes, just like what computers do, just like phones or any of the other tools that we have created as a species.
Yep, agreed. So, super interesting stuff right out of the gate, Mike. Want to talk a little bit about your experience, your journey getting to where you are today, and some of the stops along the way. So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about how you started out. Did you start out like, oh, I always want to be a technologist? Or what did your journey look like from then until now?
Yeah, David, what I always like to tell people is that I started my career as most people in AI centers do, and that was as an accountant. And obviously, that's a joke. That is true. I started my career as an accountant. I was at GE back in the days when GE was the most valuable company in the world. So this is going back quite a few years. I was doing finance and accounting there. And honestly, it was pretty clear it wasn't a fit. I left there after just a couple of years, moved to do corporate strategy roles, which was the first time like, okay, this is actually exciting. It was an exciting role in a totally unsexy industry. This was literally in the paper industry, Dunder Mifflin type paper and so forth. But still, I loved it because it was M&A. We were doing like environmental strategy stuff. It was able to dip my toes in a lot of different things. After that, started a marketplace for, this would have been 2009, started a marketplace for comic book artwork. It was a very niche collectible at a very specific use case. And the hope was that if this worked, I could eventually go into sneakers and pens and all this other stuff with all these kind of niche marketplaces. I had no idea what I was doing. I was constantly getting hacked. This is before Stripe and tools like that. Even just the payment was next to impossible. And I wasn't an engineer. I'm an accountant doing all this stuff, hiring people on Odesk at the time to help build that. So I did that for a few years. And then when kid number one came around, I'm like, okay, I probably need to get a real job because this is a net negative on the balance sheet every month. And that's when I got an opportunity to start at PayPal. And I like to tell people that I was dangerously unqualified for every single job I had at the company. I started off doing product analytics and was a product manager, did a whole bunch of other product roles there in my first half. And then when PayPal became an independent company from eBay, I got a chance to take on innovation for the company. And that was the best job I possibly could have had at the company. It was so much fun. There was so much autonomy. It was all about building a culture of innovation at PayPal. And how do we define that? What does that mean? And what does that look like? And so forth. And like, how do we inspire all of our employees to be more innovative? Did that for 6 years, left 2022 to do what I'm doing now. As I said in the beginning, I'm a fellow at San Diego State.
Super cool. What would you say was one of the most important things that you've learned along your journey? And if you can think about what life was like prior to learning that and after learning that, is there something that sticks out in your mind?
Yeah, boss matters more than job. That's one thing I learned, which as I always preach. And this is something I even talk to students about. I don't care what class it is. I don't care what the subject is. If the teacher is amazing, you take that class. It doesn't matter. An amazing teacher will expose and open you up to things that you have never thought of before, never seen before. Even if you're like, oh God, I'm really not into medieval history, all that. I have an engineering degree, but amazing teacher, just take it. Don't even think about it. And that's true with bosses in the workplace too. Because a great boss, and I could get into what my great boss test is a little bit later if you like, but a great boss is going to be your champion, is going to find opportunities for you, is going to just empower you, and is going to help you grow, especially early in your career. First 15 years of your career, seek out those amazing bosses because they will make things happen.
Yeah, that's really good advice. I had never even thought of it. Probably most recently because I'm a boss. Maybe I'm not thinking of that. But
David, maybe I could give you, I'll give you the, I teased it. So I'll give the boss test, if you will. So like, how do you know if your boss is an amazing boss? This is it. And I'm curious to see how you would react to this. If you go up to your boss and tell your boss, hey, I'm thinking about leaving. I actually was interviewing with whatever company and they gave me this thing. And I don't know, I think I might actually leave. What do you think, boss? And if your boss can actually look at you, have a real conversation and say, yeah, you should go. And it's not because you're a low performer. It's not because the company's falling apart. It's not because of all that. It's because it is actually the best thing for you, where it might not be the best thing for your boss. It's definitely not the best thing for the company. Your boss is putting you ahead of themselves, you ahead of their company, you ahead of their team, all that. If the boss truly puts you on top, that's the kind of boss you're looking for. And they're rare, but they exist. So I've had some of those bosses, but they're hard to come by.
Well, we'll have to ask my team. I like to think that I would be that way. In fact,
it's hard. I mean, because literally what I'm describing there is hard for a boss, because imagine your best performer comes up to you and you'd be like, oh my God, this is a huge gap. I have to do this. But they're being asked to whatever, serve in government or whatever it might be. And I'm like, you have to do this. No, I can never give, this is the best thing for you. As much as I'd love to do everything I possibly can, I'm going to support you so hard with this. whatever it might
be. And the more that I think about it is, oh, so in this example, if I am truly a good boss, I'm going out of my way to create an environment where people can thrive and they're challenged, but they're supported and they have opportunities to grow and they're incentivized appropriately. If they get an opportunity outside of that, that they feel is better or there's more opportunity, then that's something I really have to look at, because here I am creating this great opportunity. If there's something bigger and better, like you said, like it could be the president, or not to compare myself.
I mean, that's an extreme. I think almost then you would always defer, right? But whatever it might be. Yeah. Yeah. To actually think, what if it was going to your competitor? But your competitor is, they're taking your job at their competitor or whatever it might be. And it's, you got to do this. You're actually going to be competing with me now. And like the great bosses will be like, I'm putting you ahead of everything else. And that's ultimately what you are looking for in an amazing boss. They put you ahead of company. They put you ahead of everything else. And they're not supposed to do that, right? Boss is supposed to put company first. Boss is supposed to do all these things, but there's a rare breed that does it.
That's one of the, I think, reasons that we haven't sold out to private equity or to, we've had offers from our competitors to purchase us. And I like the fact that we can put the people first and that we can make our own rules and we can say things like family first and really mean it and really support people that just had a kid or dealing with whatever, just no questions asked, go. Yes. And I guess a lot of companies could technically be like that, but I don't know. The culture that we've created is, I think, very unique. That said, now we're at the point, and I was having this conversation the other day with a colleague and mentor about how, okay, so now the challenge is like, how do you make it scalable? Which isn't impossible, right? It's like you were in a role at PayPal where you were the creating a culture of innovation, right? That's a piece of what I want to create at a larger scale. So steps will need to be taken, but all doable.
Here's can it. Be done. Creating that culture, scaling those things out is important. When my time at PayPal, one of the policy things that really stood out to me was when we did the unlimited vacation policy. And because honestly, to me, it was only allowed in the US and some other markets. But to me, it was just like, treat us like adults here so that we don't have to book all this. Look, we all want to work hard. We want to get the work done and all that. And if somebody just started at the company and they want to get married and travel to India for 3 weeks, in the old policy, they literally couldn't do that. But now they just have a discussion with their boss about that and their teams and say, okay, I want to do this. What's it going to take? And it was hard to pivot from that being a big company of going from one to the next. But to me, that was always something that said, I was like, it seemed obvious that you should just do that. If you need to just leave midday to see your kid's soccer game or pick them up or whatever, you shouldn't have to be booking all this time. That just seems archaic. You don't trust your employees.
I that feels good to hear, because we did that out of the gate. We were just like, we work hard. And what it looks like for me sometimes, right? Every day at 5:30 Eastern, I'm home. If I'm local, right? If I'm in a different state, I'm not home. But if I'm in New York, I'm home and we're starting our routine of getting ready. We play for a half hour, we eat dinner, we do bath time, we do story time, we do bedtime. And that like time, I can't get back. And I'm like keenly aware of the value of my time today because it's so stretched. But we're working with a number of clients on the West Coast. So 7:30, 8 o'clock rolls around, the girls are to bed. My wife went to work out or is at a meeting. Sometimes I'll have to crack back open the laptop and get a few things done. I was emailing with someone from Cedars at 9:30 last night. That's okay, because that's part of the work-life integration is just, we want to get the work done. We want to work hard. And it's also incredibly important to remember, like, why are we doing this, right? Like, why do we work hard? Why do we want to do it? It's because we want to have this life outside of what we do for work too.
Absolutely. No, I think that is so right. And look, I think we want to have it all as best we can. We want to be great parents. We want to be great members of our family. And we want to be good employees that are doing well. And the more you just set those expectations with your team, you set those expectations with your customer of just saying, hey, 5:30 to 8 o'clock, I'm going to become a ghost. Yeah, if something's absolutely blowing up, sure, I can jump in. But if things are blowing up 3 days a week, then there's either problems or this isn't an actual crisis. This needs to be an exception, not a norm for those things to happen. And I think that is just completely normal and reasonable to be able to do that. Like for companies, we need to attract the best talent. That has to be the expectation. That has to be the norm. And frankly, that has to be healthy for your employees, that they need time away. They need time with family. Because believe me, if you're taking away all that family time in these precious years, David, that you have with your kids right now, you're going to resent that company for the rest of your life. And that's not what you want. That's not what anybody wants with this. We Americans, I don't even know if we work too much. I think we focus on work too much. And let work consume us and all that. And the old adage of what do you do when you're at work? You think about being at home with your kids. What do you do when you're at home with your kids? You dream about what you need to do for work and all that. That's not a healthy balance for us. Like it needs to be just, 5:30, you're done. You need to get away. You need to be with kids. You're totally offline. And do you know what? I'll see you guys at 9 if you need me for anything.
Yeah. Well, and I think about too, like growing up, like it was, if you're a man, I'm sure this was true for women too, in a lot of scenarios as well. But like I was taught, like you get that job, you become a provider. And I think seeing some of the men in my life, they were in, let me speak for myself. Like when I grew up, for a long time, I defined myself by my success in business. And that was really hard to detach from. It took a lot of life moments and self-reflection. And because today, I'm arguably I'm more successful in business than I ever have been in my life, but I stopped trying to be successful in business, which is an interesting paradigm, right? And that's not to say that I don't work hard, because I do, but it stopped being about success and it started being about serving other people and sharing freely without expectation. And when I started just doing these things in sequence, things just started happening quicker and quicker. And like the people that I'd encounter and work with, they felt like a genuine connection. And then that ethos started trickling down to the rest of the company. So everybody started acting that way. And then we just started cooking. It was crazy, but it definitely took what it took to get there.
Yeah. Look, I think in the US, I think we define ourselves way too much by what our job is. If you go to a party, you meet somebody for the first time, first question that comes out is, what do you do? And you don't get that in a lot of other countries. And just defining ourselves entirely by what our work is, it isn't necessarily healthy. I think work can be an important, fulfilling part of your life, but I think in many ways you've probably gone with too far with the Puritan work ethic of it just like consuming your identity of who you are, and even more than who you are, like what your worth is. That's your title. Suddenly, like titles are an insane thing if you really stop to think about it. Literally, it's just like a name that you would put before, and whether these are academic titles, whether they are whatever, they're just a crazy construct to somehow signify status to others. But it's important to people. It's really important. And I think all of our identities are wrapped in that. And I think you do get clarity from kids and things like that to help to put that in perspective for you of, am I going to be remembered to be like VP of blah, blah, blah? Or am I going to be remembered? Do you want to be remembered as being a great dad or mom or whatever it might be? And I think those things help to put that in perspective for sure.
100%. On my deathbed, no one's ever going to be like, oh, he was such a great VP. Payroll was on time every week. What about a time, Mike, and I want to get into a little bit about AI, some of the stuff you're writing about now. But last question would be, because I know you had a startup You've had a number of different roles. Is there a time that you either had a project fail or you had a moment where you were down, but you ultimately took a lesson, something profound away from something that happened like that? I've a lot of my pivotal moments along my journey have come out of personal, professional strife, right? And picking myself up and then looking back and being like, oh my God, I can't believe this. Is there a time that sticks out in your mind?
Yeah, I don't know why. When you were saying this, it just jumped out into my head. Maybe it was when I was running my startup. And again, so this was, it was called Sketchmaven. It was a marketplace for comic book artwork. And I was having some level of success. And I am, as I said in the beginning, I'm not an engineer. So I had people that were building the sites, paying them, I don't even know what it was, but not that much to do this on Odesk. And as they're building stuff, if it works as a user, I think they're doing a good job. But if it doesn't work, then I know. But anything beyond that, I don't know what's actually going on. And I remember our site kept getting hacked. At a certain point, maybe 6-9 months in, it kept getting hacked. And I'm like, this is so damn frustrating. And I remember then going to my in-laws over Christmas, and my sister-in-law was there, who I loved dearly. And I was explaining this to her, and she's in academia. She's not in the business world. I explained this to her. I'm getting hacked. I'm like, this is just so frustrating. I don't know what to do. And she was, and then her comment to me was like, at least that your site's important enough to get hacked. And I was like, wow. I never would have got there. And I'm like, my God, you're right. And just her saying that, this is 15 years later, I still remember that so well. It made me feel so much better. And that is just like one of many examples in life of just shifting your perspective is everything. We have these own stories in our life or whatever it is, and things could always be worse. Things could always be better. There's a problem, there's a crisis, just learn to deal with it. And to me, because she said that, because 6 months before, I was like, oh my God, nobody's using this thing, whatever. And she was right. I'm not going to have a bunch of hackers from around the world try to break into a site that has zero users. And it was like, okay. That was such a positive spin on things. And for me, the lesson is like, where in life can I put that spin myself? What are the other lessons that I can learn? And one, this is maybe another helpful tip. This is going back in the olden days. So actually before that, this is back when I was an undergrad and I was applying for jobs. And I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea what I was doing. And this is back in the days where you would get a rejection letter sent to you in the mail. So this is old school. And I was getting these rejection letters and I kept them. And at some point I went to the dollar store, which was right. I went to school in Champaign, Illinois. There was a dollar store right there. And I literally bought like 38.5 by 11 frames for $1 each. And I like literally just decorated my apartment bedroom with all the rejection letters I had. And it was a way to just, and it's funny, like I did this and I've actually heard of people do things like that since then. So I think I was not the only one, but to actually take it from, hey, oh, this sucks, another company doesn't want me, to, hey, this is a badge of honor. It's like all these logos, like Shell, gasoline, and all these companies and all that, just blanketing the wall. And I still have these. I don't have them hanging up anymore, but I actually put them in a folder. And it's just a way to take something that is a rejection and just to reframe it in a way that's empowering for you.
Yeah. No, two really awesome examples. It also makes me think about the distinction of want to versus have to, like being conscientious of the things that I have to do and the things that I want to do. And if I want to do something, let me not say that I have to do it. Let me say that I want to do it. Because there has been times where that was very significant. Also, like you mentioned, the story that we tell ourselves or that we think people have, and there was I forget if it was a leadership workshop or self-help book or what, but like if I'm communicating with someone, like one of the things that I can do is, like, particularly in my interpersonal relationships, right, is I have a story that, right? So if I don't if I don't know something's true, like I can phrase it like that and it diffuses instead of being accusatory, right? Hey, I have a story that like you think that I was an asshole last night. Is that true? No, I didn't think you're an asshole. I was pissed off about the Jets. They didn't score a touchdown last week, right? Or whatever, right?
Phrasing is really important. I think that's tremendous to use that. Yes.
Yeah. So let's get into some of your current work. Actually, before I do, I also like to ask at this point, favorite or a book that you might recommend, either that you've read recently or all time. You can go any way you might want with that. But we'd like to just hear what's on your reading list.
Wow. I'm actually going to cheat and I'm going to pull up my notes that I said. So whenever I read, shoot, for about 50 books, I try and do one a week. So I try and read a lot. And whenever I finish a book, I will always be taking notes in the book, or sometimes I do Audible. So I'll take just voice memos and stuff and just put it in there. But I always, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, humor, whatever it is, I will then always transcribe all my notes. So I have like hundreds and hundreds of notes in a file about books that I've read that I will reference back and so forth.
That's so cool.
So what's that?
Love that. That's so cool.
Yeah. No, I'm actually looking at some of the things that I have read in the last few. Okay. I'm going to give a couple different ones. A couple different ones to folks. So I'm gonna try and give a little bit of range here. I very much enjoyed Kurzweil's The Singularity Is Nearer. He wrote about the singularity and the point that man and machine will sync. It was 20 years ago, which is crazy how prescient he was with at least some of the predictions that he had in there. But this was very much an update to that. I'm just like, and frankly, it even just talks about the progress of where we have come in the world and so forth. And just to put that all into perspective of where we've come and like where we could go. So I think that was excellent. Jonathan Haidt's The Anxious Generation, which is very much all parents who have kids of device age are very much obsessed with, I would say, around Silicon Valley and probably many other places, is a great one. And the last one I'll give was very unusual for me. I just saw the title and I'm like, what the hell? I'm going to pick it up because there's a library right down the street. So I'm there literally every week. I'll just pick out some books and read a few pages, see if I like it. It was a book called Anibot. It's a work of fiction. It's a romance novel, to be honest. But the whole thing is about what, from the perspective of a robot that is built to serve a human, what is that like if the robot starts to achieve consciousness? It was really good. Really good. Yeah. So those are a few all from the last couple months that I all would recommend each of those.
I feel like I might see that last one on Netflix or Hulu soon. But
yeah, probably not for kids. I would say that one. Like that's usually not my go-to genre, but the AI angle of it was just really interesting on that. And yeah, there's a lot to be said of like, where does that take us? And it gets into so many things. Like, where are your rights? And at what point does, and I've written about this a lot in AI, like at what point will AI, does it deserve to have rights? What does that even mean? Will we ever get to that point? I don't know.
I just started thinking about robot babies and stuff like that. I don't know. There's just so many with the advancements in AI, biological advancements. There's so much there that will happen over the course of time that my little brain can't even fathom at this point. You know what I mean?
It's about, will AI ever be considered a species? And I actually surveyed a bunch of people by different countries and so forth. And there's some people who said, yeah, it could be its own species one day. But the one thing is, I was writing all this, I'm like, I think I at least need to be prepared for a future where Thanksgiving dinner comes 15 years from now and my son or daughter comes back, haven't seen them in a while. And they're like, hey, I brought my boyfriend. I'm like, oh, or a girlfriend. I'm like, oh, where is it? And then like they hold up their phone or whatever device. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. So
or they walk in with an Android. I can see
a future, basically. Yeah.
The Android girlfriend or boyfriend for sure. Anyway. So let's talk about a little bit more about AI, right? It's, after all, this is disruptive innovators, right? But it's funny. I thought this was going to be a tech podcast when I first started it. And so often we just have great conversations that are like connected or tertiary to tech. But so far, this has been great. But I do want to hear a little bit more about kind of your outlook on AI. What do you think will be some of the biggest changes as time passes, or maybe some of the things you've been writing about recently? Kind of, I'll let you drive the direction you want to take it. Just interested in hearing some of your insights on the topic.
Yeah, I think where we're already at today with the tools that are available is they can make a marked performance in most people's workflows. And I think it's hard to beat inertia. Just how people check email, how people do whatever. Like, once you've been doing something for years, it's hard to break that cycle, even with an experience that might be 10x better. But where there, and even where there are perceived shortcomings in AI. So I will say AI is not a very good writer. Since 2022, I have had AI write books, which I then publish under a pen name on Amazon. And so I think it's 14 books done so far. And I will say every one of those books sucks. They just do. But for me, this is an experiment. I give all the money to charity, all that. There's a lot of things I'm trying to figure out by doing this. And it's also a little bit of a time capsule. So you can see at some point, do these books actually go from, yeah, this feels like a seventh grader wrote it, to this feels like somebody in college wrote it. It feels like an MFA student wrote it. It feels like a published author wrote it that I would read normally. We're nowhere near that yet. But it could be a great editor. I will not publish a piece where I don't run it through Claude and ChatGPT afterwards. Both of them, actually, I run it through. I give the piece to each of them. And I say, first thing, fact check this for me. And I know that's always like a weird sounding thing to say, you have AI fact check? Doesn't it hallucinate? Doesn't it do all this? Yeah. But it also is just really good at, like, when you give it a specific task, it will start to figure things out. And if it thinks something might be wrong, I probably need to check that quote again. I probably need to do whatever it is. And at the very least, it's good at recognizing what the facts are. Usually what Claude does, it'll just say, okay, here are the facts I identify. Here are the ones that I can confirm. Here are the ones I'm not sure of. Does a really nice job of that. And then just taking it again and again. And these are ways that I could just speed up my workflow and produce a better product. Whether you're a writer or a financial analyst or a lawyer or whatever it is, there are real ways to start to do that today. And with where we're going in the future, like, if the model stopped improving today, we would still see a significant growth up and to the right of the performance of these models. Even if, you know, we literally just stopped saying, okay, no more models, everybody's done, we're not building anything else, because we haven't fully figured out what we can do with those models yet. I'm still constantly figuring out, oh my gosh, if I prompt it this way, or I didn't even know it could do this, this might lead to this other thing. And then combining models to be able to do stuff. It's extremely excited what they could do. Like, one of the best examples released in the last few weeks was a feature on Google's Notebook LM, where you can put a podcast, or I'm sorry, you can put an article, you can put a scientific paper or whatever, and it will generate a podcast for you. Usually they're about 9-minute podcasts, and it's totally free. I think anybody with a Google account can do it in the US. So I did it where all summer I was writing about AI movies. I covered about 8 different AI movies, from Metropolis through Her and a whole bunch of other ones. Dropped all of those in the Google LM, hit the podcast button, and in a few minutes, there was this podcast where you had a male and a female voice talking over each other at times, which is always a little bit surreal to hear bots like talking over each other, interrupting the ums and all these human-like qualities that are added in there. But it's actually really natural sounding. And they did a really good job of summarizing these 8 things that I spent months working on over the summer. And just think about, for me, somebody who loves to listen to stuff, books on Audible and things like that, like, this could be a much better way to learn. Like, it's not quite there yet, but you could see how it's combining summarization technology, voice technologies, putting all these different things together into one package to make just this really awesome experience.
Yeah. The implications of video, or there's so many different mediums that we can think about how AI will impact each of them and the different use cases. It's wild, really wild. But anyway, sometimes my wheels start turning when I think about AI, just because, I don't know, it's just, it's crazy to me. As a young technologist, I used to build computers and all that stuff. I would even get jazzed up by just the way that electricity works, or the way that computer chips, silicone, all that is, like, somebody had to come up with that idea, the internet in general, right? But now AI just takes it to a whole other
level. Well, I mean, let me give you an example just how jazzed I'm the same, David. Back 2021, that was the first time I ever got access to GPT-3. And I was actually writing this comedic piece about a sentient AI that becomes president and its inaugural address. And so what I did was I took actually a couple lines from Obama's address. I added some stuff. And so I gave it a paragraph starting point. And then I just threw it into GPT-3 and said, okay, go. And it would just do the next word and so forth. And I remember it doing this and like seeing, I think it was in the playground that they had, or I don't remember where exactly, but like just seeing the generation for it. And it was surreal to see that. And I remember my wife was upstairs. Like, I ran upstairs. I'm like, oh my God, like I gave it this and a computer is giving me like these other outputs. Two of these suck and one of these is maybe good, but oh my God, one of them is maybe good. And it was perfect. And it just worked so well in this piece, because then I would come back as a human and all that. And so it was this amalgamation of human and machine using this primitive technology. But it was so exciting because I'd never seen a computer do something like that where I was at the helm. I've seen machine learning engineers do this kind of stuff, but I've never seen where I'm just in plain English talking to these devices. And this is the beautiful thing about generative AI, is that you don't have to be a machine learning engineer. This is anybody who is able to type, frankly, in any local language will be able to do these amazing things. And that's something for me that got me so excited about this technology. And I'm still excited to this day. But I think some people maybe take it for granted or don't realize just how amazing that is, because they never saw like the awesome things that were being built in 2020 with AI and machine learning tools that were just like behind the scenes that us mortals like myself, who are machine learning engineers, could never do.
Right. And so many of which people don't even realize are being leveraged in all these different applications that people just take for granted.
Yeah. If you're using Google Maps, if you're using spell check, if you're using all these things, these are all, and they've been AI. If you're using a social network feed or even a YouTube feed, that's algorithmically through machine learning. It is serving up what they think the next best video is for you or all that. This is all, I don't use AI. If you're using a computer, you are almost definitely using AI tools. It might not just be like ChatGPT where you're actively, you might be passively using it through the experiences you have.
Right. 100%. This has been really great, Mike. There's one other thing I wanted to bring up. Hold on one sec. What was it? I had a great point based on the last thing you had said, and I forgot what it was. Dang nabbit. Any other, and I edit all this stuff out. Any other points that you want to land? We end with a question about if you could go back 5-10 years in time. But any other?
I think it was a great conversation. I think it was good coverage. So no, we wanted to give ending question that works for me.
Okay, awesome, Mike. This has been fantastic. I had so much fun. I imagine that this dialogue will continue in one way, shape, or form.
I hope so.
Me too. But we like to ask all our guests, just as the ending question for today, if you could go back 5, 10, 15 years in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
Oh gosh. Let's go to young Mike, who is running his own business and trying to build this comic book marketplace and running into so many problems building that site. First thing I would probably say is, good God, I wish I would have done something like the Shopify pivot. Like Shopify was a skiing or snowboarding clothing store in the beginning. And then the founder, Toby, just realized it's so hard to do this and to build this. I'm just going to build the tools so other people can do this. And like, that was the better business. And I wish I would have realized in 2009, like, there was just so much just broken with payments and all these other things. I was like, be open to the other opportunities in front of you. I say that's somewhat in jest, but more like the real advice I would give myself or whatever is like, it's going to be fine. None of the stuff that you're worried about today is going to matter. And everything is going to be okay. Spend more time with friends. Spend more time with like people you like. Spend less time with people you don't like. Organize your life that way, because like we only have so much time here. That's something I try and do today. I do often ask myself what the mic of 2040 is going to be saying to the mic of 2024. So I do ponder those questions all the time and try and live that way as best I can. That's the one piece of advice I would give to my younger self.
Love it. Mike, such a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Great talk. Thanks, David. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you all next week.
Thank you for listening to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future episodes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.